This is Bare Naked Politics, the podcast that's completely different from any other politics podcast. I would say it's much better because you don't have to be some sort of politics wizard in order to keep up. Instead, I'll just strip back all the headlines, make them really simple and easy to understand so that you can walk away from each episode feeling completely informed. Even if you haven't watched the news for a month, I'll make sure that it's easy to follow. Doesn't that sound helpful? I'm Julia Bell, and today we're talking about the Brexit deal, which is a sentence I didn't know if I'd ever be able to say, but we got a deal. It's done, agreed on by both sides. I can't believe that after 4.5 years of uncertainty, I can't believe it's been that long that Brexit's been a thing. We can now officially say we got a deal and it's happening on the 1st of January 2021. Because they really did keep us in suspense, especially over the last month. There were times where the politicians were all just saying, get ready for no deal because we just can't do it. But we're here. We made it. Now, the thing that I want to talk about today is what does it include? I'll talk about the process, how we got here, but then I want to move on to what does this deal actually say? Is it good for us? Are the EU happy with it? Was all this Brexit hassle worth it? And I think the big thing is how different will our lives look come January when this thing kicks into force? Will we feel it? A lot of big questions. There is some dry, kind of complicated stuff that I have to explain, but I promise I'll make it not dry and not complicated. But prepare yourselves for quite a dense episode. Subscribe to the podcast or hit follow if you haven't yet. That really does help me out. And without further ado. So yeah, on Christmas Eve, after basically doing a whole load of consecutive all-nighters, the EU and the UK negotiating teams finally managed to agree on a deal at the very last minute. Would it be a Boris Johnson story if it wasn't all happening at the last minute? I am starting to notice a pattern with this government.
And so I'm very pleased to tell you this afternoon that we have completed the biggest trade deal yet, worth £660 billion a year. And I want to stress that although, of course, the arguments with our European friends and partners were sometimes fierce, this is, I believe, a good deal for the whole of Europe.
So that was Boris Johnson holding a press conference all about this deal on Christmas Eve. He looked knackered. He did. You could tell that there's been lots of long nights leading up to Christmas, but he also looked immovably smug. He had this smirk the whole time, which, you know, uncontrollably broke out into massive grins at times. But that's because he kept making references to, you all told me I couldn't do this, and you kept trying to make me extend this whole deadline so we'd have to keep negotiating right through 2021. But look at me, I did it, and I didn't need any of you. And now we can focus on this pandemic. We can, you know, move on from Brexit, was his tone. Now, I know it's confusing because a lot of people are sort of saying, hang on, I thought we had a Brexit deal. I thought that was already done because Boris Johnson talked about his oven-ready deal last year in the lead-up to the election. Maybe you remember him talking about this deal that he could pop in the microwave and it was ready to go. That deal was very different to this. It was like a little starter that led to this big, bulky main course. That's kind of their relationship with each other, because the deal we agreed last year, this oven-ready one, that was called the withdrawal agreement. So that outlined how our initial divorce or departure from the EU should work. So it covered, I mean, it was still complicated, but it covered slightly shorter term issues. For example, how much money do we owe them? It had the bit in about this transition period that we're in now, where we left the EU technically at the start of February this year, 2020, but we're in a transition period where all the old rules still applied for 11 months so that we could have time to work out what the future holds without us being launched into chaos. So we've only got a few days left of that transition period. Those things were covered in that oven-ready withdrawal agreement deal. That was that one. This deal, which is the big hype right now, and it is, frankly, a much bigger deal, is the one that looks at our whole future relationship with the EU. So trade, travel, security, data sharing, how we settle disputes in the future if we fall out, because obviously we can't adhere to the EU courts because we're not a member of that anymore. The whole thing is basically covered in this, or it has bits in it that say, we can't decide on this, so let's talk about it later. But they try to cover all of those bases. And to be honest, a more accurate description of it than just calling it a deal is calling it a free trade agreement. That's what it is. You've heard people refer to it as that. It's a free trade agreement. That's what we've done. So for example, one thing that regularly crops up in a free trade agreement, and it is in this one, is let's not put tariffs on each other's goods. So if we want to trade over the border of each other's countries, let's not put tariffs. Let's make it really easy for each other without any extra prices. And giving each other perks like this, I don't care who you listen to, let's be real, it was absolutely necessary to have the EU at least have some beneficial relationship with us and vice versa, because they're our biggest trading partner. In 2019, they accounted for 43% of our exports, which was £294 billion worth of business. So all these people that were like, oh, fuck it, let's just leave without a deal and see what happens. No! No, let's not do that. Because that would have put yet more jeopardy on our biggest trading partner. So at least we have these little perks moving forward. But like I say, it doesn't just cover trade. It covers loads of stuff. It's this massive document. It's this horrible big bastard of a PDF. Johnson keeps saying it's 500 pages, but it's not. It's definitely over 1,000. It's like 1,200 and something, because the crux of the deal is 500 pages, but then it's got all these annexes and, like, you know, legal clauses and all the rest of it. So it's just dreadful, but necessary. And actually, I don't know if you saw Boris Johnson's tweet on Christmas Eve. It was like a video that he posted, and he was standing in front of a Christmas tree holding the deal as if it's like the best present that this country's ever got. And he suggested that we read it on Christmas Day.
Tonight, on Christmas Eve, I have a small present for anyone who may be looking for something to read in that sleepy post-Christmas lunch moment. And here it is. Tidings, glad tidings of great joy, because this is a deal to give certainty to business and travellers and all investors in our country from the 1st of January, a deal with our friends and partners in the EU. You remember the oven-ready deal by which we came out on January the 31st? That oven-ready deal was just the starter. This is the feast. Full of fish, by the way.
So that was what he tweeted out on Christmas Eve. I mean, I'm one of the biggest politics geeks you'll ever meet, really. And I did not touch the trade deal with a barge pole on Christmas Day. And let's be honest for a second here, what a perfect time for this deal to be finished and to be ready for Boris Johnson, because it's literally a matter of days before it becomes law. The transition period ends on the 31st of December. He came out with it on the 24th of December, and it just so happens that in the gap between those two dates, it's Christmas and New Year, which is the time that literally nobody wants to think about Brexit. So nobody in their right mind, outside of journalists, I suppose, and pundits, are actually going to read the thing before it kicks into force. And even if all of us decided as a democracy, let's sit down and read this thing cover to cover, there's no time for us as a public to protest it, because it kicks into force, like I say, on New Year's Day. So yeah, no wonder Boris Johnson's happy. I mean, did he engineer it this way? Who's to say? You know, I think the point was that they just couldn't reach an agreement and they had to keep going right past, you know, to the very last minute. But I really doubt he's upset with the timing of it. And how does the EU feel about it? What's their point of view? Well, this is what Ursula von der Leyen said about it. She's the president of the European Commission, so she is the big cheese at the EU. Really important name for you to remember, Ursula von der Leyen. And this is a clip from her press briefing on Christmas Eve.
And ladies and gentlemen, at the end of a successful negotiations journey, I normally feel joy. But today, I only feel quite satisfaction and, frankly speaking, relief. I know this is a difficult day for some. And to our friends in the United Kingdom, I want to say, parting is such sweet sorrow. So to all Europeans, I say, it is time to leave Brexit behind. Our future is made in Europe. Thank you so much.
It's an interesting quote, isn't it? You could really spend like a lot of time unpacking that. But I take from that her sort of saying, thank you, next. You know, glad we sorted it, but Britain, will you just F off? For now, thank you so much. But you can take from it what you want. So there you are. You've got a handle of the sentiment on it on both sides. Both our MPs here and the MEPs, the members of the European Parliament, will vote on this deal to approve it. And that needs to happen really before it is an official law. The UK MPs are set to vote on it on the 30th of December, one day before the transition period ends and we are out fully. So yet again, unbelievably last minute and really not enough time to vote against it or to vote it down and demand changes to it. So our MPs are kind of held hostage by the timeline of this. You might be thinking, oh my God, what if our MPs vote against this deal? What if they don't like it and they decide, you know, to vote it down? And yeah, in that event, the deal wouldn't be approved and we would be out of the EU with no deal on January the 1st. But I can categorically tell you they will approve it. They will absolutely approve it. I mean, sure, not all 650 MPs will necessarily vote for it, but Johnson will get an overwhelming majority of votes in favour of it, way over the 50% of Parliament that he needs, because even Labour have said that they'll back it and they're the main opposition. Have a listen to this.
The deal is a thin agreement. It does not provide adequate protections for British manufacturing, our financial services, creative industries, or workplace rights. It is not the deal that the government promised. A better deal could have been negotiated. But I accept that that option has now gone. The chance for renegotiation is over. There are just two paths now left for our country: to move forward with a deal or without one. And that's why I can say today that when this deal comes before Parliament, Labour will accept it and vote for it.
So that was obviously Sir Keir Starmer there, who is the head of the Labour Party, the head of the opposition, and he was disparaging, wasn't he, but also supportive, which I didn't know if that could be a combination of things, but that's what he was. He's sort of saying, yeah, we'll vote for it, but we still hate you and everything that you've ever done up to this point, but you kind of leave us no choice. So yeah, just to sum up that bit before I move on, we have a deal, or a trade and cooperation agreement, which is the kind of formal title for it. Boris Johnson, of course, did not do this all on his own. He wasn't up late negotiating this on behalf of the whole UK. We had a whole negotiating team headed up by David Frost, another really important name for you to know. He was the chief Brexit negotiator from the UK's side. But nevertheless, even though this was David Frost's baby, this will be Boris Johnson's legacy, you know? Far into the future, when he's retired or even dead, this will be what people know him for. You know, Winston Churchill, it was his approach to the Second World War that most people remember. Margaret Thatcher, you know, it was the Falklands, it was the miners' strikes, it was there's no such thing as society, that famous quote that she said, that was her. Boris Johnson is this Brexit deal. So now we just have to work out if it's any good. So what's in this deal? What does it actually say? It's mostly about trade, as I said, because it's formally called a trade and cooperation agreement. And I'll run you through some of those key bits. First thing being, we're obviously leaving the single market. The European Union's single market kind of acts like all the EU countries, all the 27 remaining member states, are just one country. They kind of pretend that they're one country when it comes to trade. So it eliminates tariffs and quotas and taxes on goods and some services, you know, crossing the border. So say, for example, you're a company and you send a certain product from Yorkshire to Lancashire, you don't come up to any, you know, customs issues, you don't have to fill out any forms. That's how the single market works for all of the EU. It's as if they're all passing products from Yorkshire to Lancashire with no bumps. And it's not just about goods. Like I said, the single market also creates free movement of services, capital and people. Slightly more complicated, but just think of it in simple terms that the single market is the freedom of goods, services, capital and people to move around from one state to another without having to do anything. And that is the thing that spurred Brexit on in a massive way, isn't it? Let's stop people from the EU coming to the UK to live and to work and to retire. So the name makes sense. The EU countries act like one single market. And it sounds cushy if you just put it like that, but don't think too hard about it because we're binning it off. So don't get attached if you've only just learnt what it is. Now, that, of course, means that because we're leaving the single market, free movement of people will end on January 1st, 2021. So immigration for people from EU countries will get much tougher as soon as we hit New Year's Day, because beforehand they could just move in and out, come and go as they pleased, and retire here if they wanted to or whatever. Now they're going to come up against this points-based immigration system. It's a really tough immigration system that the Home Secretary, Priti Patel, has put in place. And I've done podcasts on her in the past. You can look for those and learn a bit more about that. But it basically means anyone from the EU will have the same obstacles as somebody from like China or America or any other state if they want to move here. You can't just pop over here to live for a bit and go back. So the single market, binning it off. That's one thing to think about. We're also leaving the customs union. What does that mean? The customs union, it's a similar kind of thing, really. It describes the EU's pact, so an agreement, amongst all of its member states to apply the same tariffs and the same taxes to goods that come in from outside the EU. So, for example, once something clears customs in one country, it can be shipped around all the others without any further checks. Again, like acting like one country, but this time when it comes to dealing with outside countries. That's what the customs union is. So a Japanese car, for example, like a Hyundai, that's not a product from an EU state. It's a Japanese product. So an EU state, whether it's Poland, France, Spain, Portugal, they're all going to treat it the same with regards to customs, kind of acting like one big state. So again, the name makes sense. The EU countries are a union when it comes to customs, and we're leaving it. So it's weird. I'm trying to define these things to you that actually don't matter because we're not part of them anymore. And that means that our trading relationship, frankly, to put it super frankly, will deteriorate with the EU. But it's very important to sort of mention that this is what the UK government wants. Bear that in mind. This is what they wanted, was to deteriorate to some degree our relationship with the EU. Because if we're out of the single market and if we're out of the customs union, we don't have to play by EU rules anymore. And that's what we did this whole thing for. We want to take back control. Remember, that's the slogan they kept on using. We want to listen to our own courts. We don't want to listen to your justice courts. We want to contribute to our own economy. We don't want to have to keep paying in to the EU money pot. We want the freedom to develop trading relationships with other states outside of the EU. We don't want to just be trapped in this system where we have to ask you guys what we're allowed to do if we're dealing with, you know, Hyundais from Japan, for example. And that's the point, really, that Brexiteers will say is this whole thing gives us a chance to maybe strike up beneficial relationships and trade agreements with non-EU states. A big one being America, of course, which our government are kind of unashamedly thirsty to get. Now, I mentioned earlier, in this deal, we actually have held on to some small elements of the single market in the sense that we're not going to put tariffs or quotas on goods between the EU and the UK. If you don't know what quotas are, it's like a maximum amount for how many goods you can trade across a border. We're not going to have that, so you can trade as much as you want. So that is one perk that this deal gives us, is that if we had no deal Brexit, we would have watched tariffs get whacked on goods coming in and out of the EU, which would not have been fun. Let's be honest. Come on. No deal would have not been fun. So that is something. But the EU didn't just give us that without a catch. Because if you think about this from their point of view, throughout the negotiation, they were really concerned that, oh, the UK are just going to ask for special access to our market, but they're going to have no obligation to worry about meeting our standards. So all their businesses are just going to undercut our businesses because they're all going to be free to do whatever they want and they're not going to have to meet with our strict rule book. So what the EU said is, look, if you want access to our market and you want to have these little perks where we don't have tariffs for each other's goods, you're going to have to meet some of our standards because otherwise it's just not fair. Because then you could undercut us on things like, for example, the EU have rules on how long labourers can work. So, for example, like a lorry driver, how long can they work before they have to rest by EU law? They have rules on that, or they have rules on environmental standards. So if we just undercut everything, but we still had access to their market, it's not fair. And they've said, no, you've got to abide by our standards. So we've had to compromise and actually abide by some of their rules still. So when they're telling you that we're our own boss and we don't have to listen to them anymore, take it with a slight grain of salt because we are still following some of their rules. That being said, we have completely binned off the EU when it comes to the customs union. So we are following some standards in order to get some perks with tariffs on goods. But customs, no, you can shove your rules, frankly. So that means come January 1st, we are or UK companies are going to have annoying things to do if they trade with EU companies. Because we're going to have to fill out customs forms. We're going to have to adhere to safety checks that we didn't have to before. We're going to have to just do basically more bureaucracy than we've ever had to do. Or at least we had to do before the 70s when we joined the EU. So what will that translate as? Hold-ups. I will be surprised if we don't have hold-ups with getting certain products and with us getting products to them. Obviously, because if you run a company, let's say you're a British company owner and you make a product like a pork pie, say you have big clients in France and Spain, you'll be going from having no restrictions at all and just shipping over your pies as if you're sending them to somewhere else in the UK. You know, it's that easy. To now, come January 1st, you'll have to fill out customs declarations. You'll have to prove that you've hit certain safety standards with your meat products. You'll maybe even when you get to the border, have to open up your lorry and have somebody come in and check all the products and make sure that they're all okay. That translates for your clients in France and Spain as them just not getting your products as quickly as they used to, which is not good for business. But the UK government are saying, look, it'll be worth it. And it's not even going to be that bad. It'll be a bit uncomfortable to begin with, but we'll get used to a new system. And because the EU is such a big trading partner, we're both going to want this to work out. So don't worry too much about it. We've done you a favour because we've opened up all these other doors by closing this door on the EU. It's up to you how you decide to feel about that. But that's their stance on it. Now, that's a big bulk of this deal kind of summarised, is how we handle goods. One thing that you've probably noticed I've not talked about yet is services. And that's because, kind of unsettlingly, there isn't a massive amount on services in this deal, which is no doubt making service industry titans in the UK, of which there are many, incredibly nervous. Because services, it accounts for the bulk of our economy. We are a services economy, not a goods economy. And you might be thinking, well, if that's the case, why does this deal not say much about services? And the thing is, agreeing on a trading agreement for services would require much more rules for us to have to follow from the EU than just goods. It's quite straightforward to sort out what we do with goods, but with services, we'd have to really align with the EU's playbook. So the UK negotiators were actually the ones to say, no, even though we're a services economy and this is probably going to slightly fuck us, we're not going to adhere to any more rules than we already are. So no, thank you. Does this make us vulnerable? Yes. Yes, it does. That is the answer to that question. It is going to cost us jobs. It is going to create holdups. It's going to hurt our service industries, maybe in the short term, maybe not in the long term. I don't know. But it is for now. But the Brexit vote wasn't necessarily about that, was it? It was about sovereignty. It was about, let's stop following EU rules and let's forge our own path, even if it means that we take a bit of a hit economically in the short term. Okay, that's the trade and free movement and all that stuff, kind of in a nutshell. Definitely read more about it if you're a business owner. I imagine that you will have by now anyway. Also, if you're a Northern Irish listener, you're probably already kind of familiar with what the situation is going to be, but trading rules for you are going to be slightly different for anyone listening who's English, Scottish or Welsh, because you have this interesting and I would say tricky situation. You share a border with the EU because you share a border with the Republic of Ireland, which is an EU member state still. And the really tricky thing about this is obviously Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland have this very contentious and violent history, which isn't in too distant a history for us all to have forgotten. We still need to be careful about that border. We still need to make sure that no hard border and physical checks crop up in between Northern Ireland and Ireland, because that could bring back terrible memories and it could, frankly, break the relationship back down, which we worked very hard as a bunch of nations to build up in the Good Friday Agreement. So the kind of solution that Boris Johnson and the UK team came up with alongside the EU is to almost have a border between the rest of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. Not in sense of, you're not going to see like a big physical thing crop up in the middle of the sea, but insofar as things are going to have to be checked before they hit the border of Northern Ireland. So if you're sending something from Wales, you know, if you're sending something from Cardiff to Belfast, it's going to have to be checked on the way to Belfast. Then that means if it happens to go through into the Republic of Ireland, you know, through to Dublin, for example, at least it's not going to have to be checked because it's already been checked from Great Britain. It already matches EU policy. Does that make sense? So it kind of avoids the issue of building a hard border. It's not ideal, and a lot of people in Northern Ireland are really cross about it because they're like, well, this kind of separates us from the rest of the UK. We're meant to be a united kingdom, but now we're having to straddle your rules as well as EU rules, and we're kind of separated on our own. So a lot of people think it's the worst, but this is the solution that was arrived at. And actually, that isn't really covered in this deal. It was more so covered in the little deal that we sorted out last year, this kind of withdrawal agreement divorce deal. If you want to learn more about that, because I know that was an unbelievably quick summary and it's a deeply complicated issue, you can Google the Northern Irish Protocol. That's the name of the arrangement that they've come to with Northern Ireland. But that's what's happening with that. If you wanted a brief understanding, hopefully that'll tide you over. I want to unpack the rest of this trade deal in more depth, because like I say, it's a big document. It doesn't just cover trade, it covers loads of stuff. But I don't want to do it on my own. Instead, I kind of want to give you a balanced outlook. Like, let's have two different views and let's have them challenge each other, and then you can make your own mind up. So I got Joe Barnes on FaceTime yesterday. Joe is the Brussels correspondent at The Express. And if you know about kind of each newspaper and what it stands for, you probably know that The Express is a pretty pro-Brexit paper. They like Brexit over at The Express. So if you're a diehard Remainer, chances are you're not so familiar with Joe's work. But I thought it'd be fun to have him on so we can go through the deal. He's obviously pretty content with it. I have some concerns, and that means you can get both sides. So here's what happened with that. Hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good, how are you?
Can't complain.
How long have I got you?
As long as you want. I've got nothing to do.
So 3 hours, yeah?
If you really want to.
Well, this deal's over 1,000 pages long, so if we went through it word for word, it would take longer than that. But we have a Brexit deal. They actually did it.
We do. I always thought there was going to be a deal, and I was kind of laughing at people. They were always going, oh, Boris doesn't really want a deal. He doesn't ever want a deal. He wants no deal. And I was like, no, look, there's going to be a deal. Look, I was 110% sure. But then we got into that last few days, kind of really coming up to Christmas, and everyone involved in the process was absolutely shattered. Everyone's put on about 2 stone, being fueled by takeaway pizzas and crap sandwiches.
Is that a noticeable thing? People put on weight who are negotiating?
Yeah, and that was kind of a running theme. There was they did weeks in what was known as the Bay's basement, the business department's underground bunker. Mm-hmm. In London doing the negotiating, and they were being fed off pizzas and sandwiches. And then these guys were working 16, 17 hour days. And it was literally just takeaways and kind of booze when you could fit it in.
Did you say booze?
Yeah, there was the occasional, the occasional beers were snuck in, and I'm sure bottles of wine were consumed. And like, it's stressful. You need to let them have a break sometimes.
Thing is, though, I think this is the main thing that everyone's asking me. Is this a deal that people who voted Leave should be happy with? Did we get the deal that the Vote Leave campaign promised we could get?
Yeah, I actually think Boris Johnson has actually... Look, let's take away the trade aspect, but in a political sense, he's delivered on his promises. Britain has now let, or is due to leave on January the 1st, the single market, the customs union of the EU. There will be no, in the trade deal, there is no EU law, there is no European Court of Justice judges overseeing us from Luxembourg. We are taking control back of our fishing waters a bit in 2026 after another transition period. But yeah, Boris has delivered on what he set out to do. And that was basically, he was like, look, we'll try and minimise the trade damage, but what we want to do is we want to be able to shape and craft our own laws, our own regulations, our own standards coming out of the British Parliament rather than kind of things that happen in Brussels and in Luxembourg and in Strasbourg. So yeah, look, it probably makes his job a lot harder. If we remained in the EU, he would always have a scapegoat in Brussels to kind of bounce off. Now he doesn't have that. He doesn't have that safety net.
So you think he's made his life harder in a way?
I think so, but is that for the better? Maybe. We'll find out in 10 years' time.
But you answered that in quite an interesting way because, you know, I said, is this the deal that we wanted? And you said, well, let's put trade aside for a second. Everything else is great. But this is a trade agreement. That's the main bulk of this thing is trade. And by all the accounts I can see, it's going to be bad for a while.
Michael Gove said the other day that there is going to be a bit of kind of trade friction. There's going to be new customs forms and new checks that have to happen at the border when we're trading with the EU markets, which is completely foreign to us. A lot of companies will struggle at first to kind of come to terms with what they need to do. And are we going to be ready when we leave the transition period? Not probably, probably not.
Not probably, probably not.
For the average consumer, I don't think much is going to change. I think Tesco's came out the other day and said, we don't expect food prices to dramatically change. I don't think our lives as consumers is going to change much. If you run a business, yes, there is going to be extra kind of paperwork to fill in. There's going to be extra hurdles and extra stumbling blocks that you have to do and pass if you want to do business and trade with the EU markets. But I personally don't think we're going to see a great deal of difference from a consumer's point of view.
But there's more bureaucracy involved. So I would have thought that would mean, so for example, like you say, we have to now fill out these customs forms on products that we didn't have to do before. That will start on the 1st of January. So I would imagine that would mean you're going to get holdups because people are going to be stopped at the border. Right, have you got all your paperwork? We've got these safety precautions now that you have to follow that you didn't have to follow before. I would expect that would mean you're going to see queues and queues at Dover.
This is interesting. And you've got to remember the people that run the Port of Dover, people that run Calais, the Eurotunnel, these are private businesses as well. They are not going to want to see pictures of queues and queues and queues mounting up at the border because that's bad for their business. Why? As soon as you see a queue at Dover, the companies, the logistics teams go, oh, don't go to Dover, get yourself down to Felixstowe or wherever and get yourself over into Belgium via that route. So these businesses, and I know the Eurotunnel spent an obscene amount of money, tens of millions of pounds, making sure that they've got systems for linking the two customs regimes. So you're coming from Britain, you can upload your forms into their system. And when you're in the tunnel, your forms then get sent to the other side to be checked.
So it's kind of smoother.
Yeah. So look, there will be problems at first, like teething problems. Like I'm sure like when you first set up your podcast, how did you do it? You have to feel your way into something. That will happen. But eventually, I just don't really think we're ever going to notice the difference because you could do things digitally and kind of we'll build systems for making sure that there isn't friction at the border.
I just wish that those systems that you're so confident are going to come in were in place. They're not. Like this is going to kick off on the 1st of January. And then you're sort of saying, well, we'll find ways to make it less shit. Once it's shit.
But and as I think I said at first, this is, yes, it's a trade deal. Yes, it's a security deal. But I think Boris Johnson's main aims weren't kind of making it easier to trade with Europe. It was reclaiming sovereignty. So
yeah, sovereignty and taking back control over everything else. And speaking of taking back control, we've got to talk about fish. I can't believe how big a topic fish and fishing has been throughout this whole process. So the EU, particularly France, wanted access to waters surrounding the UK to fish in. And we were like, no, there are waters now. We want full control, as Boris Johnson would say. So what does this deal say about fishing?
What I will say is at first, it wasn't just France. The Danes, Denmark were really quiet.
Those Danes.
Yeah, the pesky Danes. Peter Schmeichel and co. wanted our fish as much as the French. No, so what the deal does is it sets in place from the point of leaving up until 2026, we'll have about 2/3 of the fish in British waters will be caught by British boats. So up until June 2026, there is a set kind of amount that each fisherman can catch, whether you're being an EU fisherman or a UK fisherman in British waters. And then they will look and have another negotiation after 2026 about what we can catch again. And then the British idea is that you have negotiations every year to decide what the EU can catch in British waters going forward. Actually, it's really easy to explain how you reclaim sovereignty by saying we've got full control over our waters.
But we don't have full control over our waters. We don't. EU is still allowed in and they're still allowed to fish. Granted, it's a diminishing proportion every year, but they're still, this full control is a lie. They're still allowed in.
They are allowed in, but it's kind of, look, it's a thinly veiled politicking of saying all control, because in 2026, Britain would be able to close the door if it wants to.
Okay.
Would it? No, because that would then kind of.
That's the point. That's why it's annoying, because like, they're not going to close the door.
It's now Britain has sovereign control over its waters, which it didn't have under the Common Fisheries Policy. Yeah. It says it a British government, a guy sitting or girl sitting in number 10 in the future, will be able to make a choice and say, EU fishermen, you can come in, or you can. We're shutting up shop, and you can go away.
Okay.
That's essentially what the deal does.
I think that's quite annoying for whoever, someone right now is unaware of the fact that one day they're going to be prime minister, and even they are going to be dealing with this issue. This seems to be a common theme with this deal of, look, this is the plan for now, but we'll renegotiate it later when Boris Johnson isn't even prime minister anymore. So I actually saw this Dave Keating quote, and it said, we're going to have a forever Brexit because of this deal. In other words, we're just going to be negotiating forever. Do you think that's the case?
In my eyes, Brexit is now very much done.
Is that just because you want it to be?
Yes, because it's taken a toll on my personal life, on everything. No, what we've done is we've set ourselves up a future relationship. And I like Dave. He's a really good bloke. But I think he's also being a bit disingenuous, because once you have a free trade agreement, so the EU has a free trade agreement with, say, Japan and stuff, they all still carry on talking. It's as natural and healthy, because what it does is it sets up a future relationship. Like, just because you've, like, your boyfriend or your girlfriend, you've just gone, oh, we're together now. We've got a relationship. We've got the deal. We've bought a house together. You still carry on talking, don't you? That's what we've done. We've set up a relationship that's different from our EU membership.
Okay. Looking at travel now, how much more faff are we facing with this deal? If you want to just jump on the Eurostar from London to Paris for a quick weekend, will that be any different come January 2021?
So instantly, the things that you'll need 6 months on your passport at least to cross the border. We won't get to use those fast lanes when we land down in, when we touch down in Europe on the mainland, the EU passport gates, as they're known. So we will be lining up with people from America, from China, Japan, basically any non-EU state. We are only allowed to visit 90 days out of 180. So we can't just basically, because we've left the free movement theory. So we can't come and go as we please. We've got to kind of respect EU rules, and their current visa free travel guidelines is basically you're allowed 90 days out of 180 days before you get kicked out. And if you don't have a good reason for still being there, you get fined or banned.
And that 90 days maximum within a 180 day period, that's not necessarily in one block, is it? They're talking about 90 days that can stack up over multiple trips to different EU countries. So, for example, if you're in a long distance relationship with somebody and they live in like Germany and, you know, you live in the UK, you have to really plan out your visit so that you don't bleed over the 90 day threshold and end up getting banned. Or if you're somebody, you know, almost even worse, if you do business in lots of EU countries, you're going to have to seriously budget your trips. Unless, of course, you get a visa. And then
unless you get a visa.
Yeah, because I was thinking about, you know, for instance, musicians. I had somebody message me about this on Instagram saying, what happens if, for say, an example, a UK artist had plans to do a tour around Europe? It would be limited unless they got a visa, right?
Touring musicians aren't actually covered by this. So this is one of the parts I feel quite sorry for new bands. So they will have to start applying for visas like you do if you're going to America, because technically they're going to work.
Yeah.
They're not going on holiday. So, because when we enter, because we're going to Iron Appa for the weekend or whatever we do, we're going there for pleasure.
Yeah.
If you're a band going over to Europe, you're going there for work purposes. And they're currently not covered, so they will have to apply for visas, and they'll have to apply for their extra staff that come with them, the road crew and the drivers, the managers and stuff, all have to basically apply for work-based visas to come and tour Europe if they want in the future.
Where we didn't have to do that before, because you could work wherever you liked within the EU. That was the point, right? Free movement means it's not just travel. You can work wherever you like in the EU, and we just can't do that anymore.
No, exactly. So it's
such a shame, man. It's so sad. How can you not think that's sad?
There is. I feel greatly, greatly. Well, because, say, from being in Brussels, I love when British bands come to play locally, and I will go and deliberately watch them, even if I've never heard of them, because they're British.
Aww.
It's one of the kind of the great things about it. But yeah, that is one of the downsides of it. Mm-hmm. But could Boris have then fulfilled his manifesto pledge? No, he wouldn't have been able to, because one of them was to basically stop EU immigration, and that is free movement. So
yeah, that was their issue. It wasn't necessarily UK folk working and living in the EU. They just wanted to stop EU member state people popping over to the UK to work. They didn't love that.
No, exactly. And it's whatever you think about Brexit, that's probably one of the downsides of Brexit, is that you can't just hop over to the continent and enjoy yourself basically frictionlessly.
And speaking of enjoying yourself, Erasmus. That's another bummer about this deal, is Erasmus won't be a thing anymore. That, of course, for anyone who doesn't know, is the EU scheme where students from EU member states can live and study in any other EU member state that takes part. I did it. I went to Warwick University in the UK, but they had the Erasmus scheme, so I ended up spending a year in Bordeaux at the Sciences Po. And it was... Huh?
How wonderful.
I know! And I'm so sad, because that's just not going to be available to British students. Although it will be for Northern Irish students, right?
The Irish government are trying to put together some sort of plan that means that Northern Ireland's part of the same single Irish economy,
yeah,
the all-Ireland economy, will be able to access some sort of Erasmus scheme in Northern Ireland. I know the Scottish government in Holyrood has asked Westminster, can it look at kind of having its own deal with the EU to join Erasmus again? But Boris Johnson in number 10 has basically taken a firm decision to not join Erasmus, mainly for a political look. He has basically thought that it doesn't fit in with his levelling up agenda, because he basically sees Erasmus as posh people, posh students benefiting.
Pot kettle black.
Yeah, well, which is brilliant. It's great. And then another, he basically said it doesn't kind of fit in with Northern kids.
I'm Northern.
No, it's incredible.
This is total shit. So is the point like, oh, Erasmus doesn't really fit because it is the embodiment of free movement. Why don't we pay for you to move to a different country and spend time there, live there, study there, work there? That doesn't fit in with Brexit, which is stop people moving around from the UK to the EU and vice versa.
Yeah, look, you could say that, but they basically taken the decision, and one of the kind of elements on that was they've decided to cut foreign aid spending. And it was like, why should we stop sending money to kids in Africa while we're then sending our kids elsewhere?
Like posh kids that can already afford to go to... Okay.
Yeah, that's kind of the argument they've made. But they have announced, and we haven't got the plans for it yet, Gavin Williamson has announced that it's called the Alan Turing Scheme, which is basically going to be a UK-led Erasmus, but it's not going to be with European countries, or it could be with European countries, but it's going to be a global sort of Erasmus scheme. So instead of going off to Bordeaux, you could end up in Mexico or America or Australia or something. So they're trying to replace it. I basically think the government line on that is they said they were willing to explore joining Erasmus, but they would only join if it made economic sense for Britain. And apparently the numbers didn't quite match, and it doesn't quite match with their political goals of levelling up the North and being seen as the people's government rather than kind of a bunch of rich toffs from Oxbridge.
Do you know what worries me about this deal, on top of all the other worries that I've voiced today, is the security thing. Because in that, we're going to be kicked out of the EU's sort of inner circle of security information, which makes total sense because we're not going to be a member anymore. So we're not entitled to that sort of top secret stuff. But beforehand, I liked the idea that we all collaborated and we all pooled our resources for example, tracking terrorist activity. What happens now that we're, in essence, left to our own devices? Is there an arrangement in this deal for us to have some access to their security?
Yes, and actually one of the things that a lot of kind of Eastern European states, and France especially as well, they wanted Britain to have a really good security relationship with the EU, because we are kind of one of the more trusted nations in this sense, that we have a really good police force, we have great intelligence sharing, we have good international links with other countries like America and stuff like that. So yeah, it's not as good as EU membership, but there is a limited kind of bilateral exchange between the EU and UK for future information. Mm. So there is an agreement that provides for DNA, fingerprints and vehicle registration data, There is passenger name records. So basically, if you get on a plane and or train, there is some sort of level for exchange there. There's cooperation with Europol, which is basically a European-wide police force. So I think that's actually one of the big kind of triumphs of Brexit, is that we've been able to actually maintain that. And both sides have kind of seen sense in having it.
Yeah, I feel like surely that would have been one of the easiest compromises to make. Let's stomach helping each other out, even though we're not getting on, because this helps us both.
And, yeah.
I had a really good question from someone on Instagram. Here we go. Taylor DM'd me asking, how similar is this deal to what Theresa May would have brought us if she was still in charge? What would you say about that?
Completely different. So different. Boris Johnson has decided to diminish trade, make trade harder for reclaiming sovereignty. Theresa May was trying to reclaim sovereignty but keep trade the same.
Which I can, as someone who is slightly worried on behalf of all the business owners in the UK, I can see why she was trying to do that. I mean, this deal doesn't say anything about services, and that is the bulk of our economy. What's the plan there? At least if we'd kept ourselves within the framework of the EU's customs union and so on, we would have had a plan.
So it does have some provisions for services. So delivery drivers.
Great.
Lawyers do quite well out of it. But financial services, you're right. Our big kind of go-to industry, the City of London, doesn't have any provision. They've set out a declaration of kind of good faith and good hope and goodwill. Mm-hmm. But that's going to be a negotiation for next year.
Forever Brexit.
Forever Brexit. How do we solve having a financial services relationship? Under Theresa May, the European Court of Justice would have still had a role to play in the UK.
Which wouldn't have fit, of course, yeah, with the concept of us taking back control.
Free movement would have had to basically carry on, because you can't cherry pick the four freedoms. But Theresa May basically wanted to have free movement of goods, free movement of services, free movement of currency, but she was trying to shut off free movement of people.
Mm.
So that's why the EU never really liked her idea in the first place. At least Boris Johnson was basically saying, we don't want free movement at all.
So he was a bit easier in a way to negotiate with, because it was more clear cut.
Yeah, exactly. They kind of, you knew where you stood, and you kind of, if you speak to Europeans, they were like, we never really knew what Theresa May wanted. At least with Boris, we knew exactly what he wanted, even if we didn't agree with it. But actually, it was a goal that we could work towards. Where Theresa May was like, well, we want this, but we can't do this. What can you do for us and stuff like that?
Yeah, our economic forecasting team in the UK, aka the Office for Budget Responsibility, which has to be the most depressing name for any body of people ever, they've said, with this deal, we're going to come out of this whole thing 4% smaller as an economy than if we'd stayed in the EU and if we'd not bothered with Brexit. So out of this, we're going to be 4% worse off. That seems shit to me. That does not seem good. How are the government going to spin that to say, no, look, it's all still worth it. This was all still a very good idea.
But it goes back to what I said right at the beginning, was now they are democratically electable and they've got to, they have to own this. They will own this. So when's the next election? In 2024?
Yeah.
Boris Johnson, if he runs again, we don't know. Or the next government, is going to have to say, this is what we've done. Like, you've got to vote for us on the basis of what we've done. And they can't hide behind Brussels or anyone else. They are going to have to own this. And Boris Johnson knew, and I think actually David Frost knew very quickly, having a conversation with him right at the beginning of his process. And I actually asked him the same question. I said, is this government willing to accept a detrimental agreement on trade to get what it wants in terms of its political goals, its sovereignty, its kind of taking back control of laws, borders and waters? And he's like, yeah, absolutely, that's what we want. So they've got to own it and live it.
I just don't think this is what Leave voters bargained for. At no time can I recall the Vote Leave campaign saying, yes, the UK will gain more control over its own affairs, but in the process, we will definitely lose money and in fact shrink our economy. That was not mentioned. In fact, the Leave campaign said, let's spend all this EU money on ourselves. All the money that we ship over there, let's spend it on the NHS. We'll be richer at the other side of this. That was all a big lie, wasn't it?
Yeah, probably, yeah. It was. Well, actually, and I know some really kind of hardcore Brexiteers that have worked for like the Brexit Party and UKIP over the years. And even they questioned and called the vote leave number of 350 million a week for the NHS a complete lie. So
that bus belongs in the bin.
It's got a lot to answer for. But at the end of the day, this is a vote leave government. Boris Johnson, Michael Gove, they were the two main politicians. A lot of their kind of political spads, I won't name names because they're not politicians, it's not fair on them, but they are working for them and they worked on vote leave as well. So actually, if the NHS comes out at the end of this process in, say, 4 years' time when it comes up to the election and it's not had loads of money pumped into it, then people are going to be angry, and that's fair enough. This is, I think, what's great, and it's an interesting time still for British politics, is that actually now kind of these Brexiteers have got to make this vision work.
Yeah.
And I, as you say, I probably wouldn't want to be in charge right now.
Well, listen, thank you so much. It was really fun to speak to you. All right. Thanks again. See you later. So that was Joe Barnes, a Brussels correspondent for The Express. I'll leave his details in the episode description if you want to check out his Twitter and read some of his work. I really like that we obviously don't agree on everything, and he let me give him a bit of a hard time and it didn't faze him. He was a good sport. But yeah, that gives you quite a substantial run through of lots of the components of this deal and some of the pros and cons on either side. And the main things I took away from our conversation are that, you know, trade is going to be bruised in us leaving the single market and the customs union. No one's denying that, especially when it comes to the service industries, because we just don't have much clarity about how that relationship's going to look. But the government are happy because we got our sovereignty. We got our freedom. And that's a hit that they were willing to take, at least in the short term, because their hope is that this freedom to forge our own path will open more doors than it closes. Now that we don't have to follow EU rules, we can make our own decisions and forge our own relationships. And for those of you who are thinking, do you know what? After 4.5 years of shit about Brexit, I'm going to read this deal. You know, it's been a long time coming. I'm just going to sit down and dedicate some time to reading it. Firstly, I say good for you. I'm intrigued to hear how you get on. I can't say it's a riveting read, but you'll definitely feel more comfortable with what's happening on January 1st if you just read it. And I tell you what, I'll link the PDF in the episode description. Don't download it because it'll explode your computer, but just read it online and have fun. Okay, what an episode that was. I feel emotionally drained. I'm going to need a lot of wine because I've spent a long time talking and thinking about Brexit. But I hope that, you know, as the news develops in the coming days and weeks, you're going to feel more on top of it because you've become quite comfortable with quite a few components of this deal. Before I let you go, my recommendation of the week, and this is going to be a complete antidote to everything I've just been talking about, is anything, just get anything, by the author Matt Haig. Just anything that he's ever written, I promise you'll really like it. I've never felt more comfortable about recommending anybody than recommending him, because this is a tough time of year for most people, even in normal times. But we're dealing with a pandemic. We've got a bumpy road ahead with us leaving the EU on the 1st of January. And I know that this is going to be tough for a lot of us, including myself, frankly. But I would really recommend just pick up a book by Matt Haig, and you'll never feel more comforted and kind of uplifted than by his words. How to Stop Time is my favourite of his, but also Notes on a Nervous Planet, I know, has been kind of particularly life-changing for a lot of people. He's also really worth a follow on Instagram and Twitter, because he kind of gives you everything you want. He's really open and really vulnerable. He talks about mental health a lot, but in a really inspiring way. But he also gets into spats with celebrities, which is always fun to watch. You'll love to see it. Him and Piers Morgan are in a particularly toxic rivalry, which is always quite enjoyable to see. So check him out, Matt Haig, his newest book, Midnight Library. I got it just before Christmas. I got a signed one because I'm that kind of a fan, and I literally can't wait to jump in immediately after I finish recording this podcast. Other than that, I will kindly ask, if you find this podcast helpful, please, please give it a 5-star rating and leave a nice review. It really helps me, but it also helps other people discover it and to find me. So it'll take 2 minutes of your time. Please do that. And if you want to support me further and you want to help keep this podcast going, you can become a patron. The link is in the episode description to do that. You essentially buy me a coffee and you get access to exclusive content that no one can see unless they're a patron. So you get explainers, you get updates, and you get opinion pieces. So check it out if that sounds good. Okay, happy new year. I'm sending love and positive vibes. It's going to be a weird start to the year, but you've got me. If you need any confusions clearing up, just message me on social media and I will answer your questions in future podcasts. I love you guys so much. I'll speak to you in the next one. Okay, bye.